have been created for the good of the human beings. What? Because you have been told and you have been ordered to perform this Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy an Munkar. With this rule, we have been selected and elected as the best of the nations on the scene of the earth. You see? So it is very important to play our role in society as it is expected from us, based on our abilities. So we have to understand when we have, as I said earlier, when we thought on our duties, personal one, then we know what is our
social duty as well. So you're trying to say social reform can come with self-reform.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alevi, for being with us.
You're welcome.
May Allah give us the capability to know Imam, to know his position, to cling to Wilaya. May he increase our patience to wait for Imam, and may he give us the capacity to purify ourselves and to make self-reforms and social reforms, inshallah. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, sister.
Thank you, listeners, for you are listening to The Last Savior from IIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood made headlines once again on Sunday. Clashes broke out between Israeli forces and Palestinian residents in the area after far-right Jewish lawmaker Itamar Ben-Gvir opened a parliamentary office in Sheikh Jarrah. Tens of Palestinians were injured in the Israeli crackdown. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned Ben-Gvir's step as a provocative and escalating move that threatens to ignite violence. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the Israeli regime is fully and directly responsible for the escalation in the occupied Al-Quds and potentially dire consequences of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It added that the failure of the international community and the United Nations Security Council to take necessary measures to compel Israel to stop its occupation of Al-Quds encourages the occupying power to forge ahead with its colonial Judaization projects in the Holy City.
Well, that was expected, and he did it largely as a publicity stunt and to raise his profile within Zionist politics in Israel, and of course to shove it in the face of the Palestinian Christian and Arab or Muslim community that lives in the area. But it was designed for controversy. But it definitely is a political stunt, and it's designed to increase tensions in the area. And this is most unfortunate and illegal, and mostly condemned around the world. As an attempt to Judaize the area and to drive out the Palestinians.
Earlier, the Hamas resistance movement had issued a strongly worded message of warning to the Israeli regime and settlers after the latter renewed their attacks on Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Mohammed Hamadeh, a spokesman for the Gaza-based movement, said the attack amounts to a clear violation and that Israel was playing with fire. Israel's attempts to evict families from the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood resulted in an 11-day war between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups and Israel back in May. Israel is evicting Palestinians to make way for its settlement-building activities. This is while under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Al-Quds remains at the heart of the decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East Al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers believe any escalation of violence or provocative action by Israeli forces in the holy city could serve as a prelude to a new intifada.
It is part of the Judaization of East Jerusalem, and it's an attempt by Zionists to drive the Christian and Muslim Arabs out of the city and increase the Jewish population.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's unqualified support, Tel Aviv expanded its illegal activities against the people of Palestine. Many were expecting a turn of events when Trump left office, but the regime continues to carry out its acts of aggression in the absence of any meaningful action from the international community.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini courts' dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al-Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al-Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq Movement, Hassan Mashaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdeljalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems, but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution. Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community. Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks. As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE, Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region. but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
In the limelight. The deadly impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the most deprived areas of England and Wales has been even more pronounced than first thought, according to research that reveals the northwest of England lost three times more years of life than the southwest. Deaths have been unevenly distributed socio-economically and geographically ever since the crisis began. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's health editor, Andrew Gregory. The piece is titled, COVID Impact in Poorer Areas of England and Wales, Worse Than First Thought. The deadly impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the most deprived areas in England and Wales has been even more pronounced than first thought, according to new research that reveals the northwest of England lost three times more years of life than the southwest. Deaths have been unevenly distributed socio-economically and geographically ever since the crisis began. However, until now, the full scale of inequalities has been underestimated, a study published in the journal PLOS Medicine has suggested. Comparing the number of deaths during the pandemic with data from previous years can shed light on its impact, researchers said. But looking at excess deaths alone underestimates years of life lost and does not account for the differences in ages at which people die in different social groups. In the new study, led by the University of Manchester, researchers measured years of life lost attributable to the pandemic, directly or indirectly, as well as excess deaths. Years of life lost is a strong measure of premature mortality because it takes into account both the number of deaths and the age at which they occur. The findings of the new analysis are striking, Manchester University researchers say, and suggest the true toll of the pandemic has been even deadlier in poorer areas of England than initially thought. The impact of the pandemic, when quantified using years of life lost, was higher than previously thought on the most deprived areas of England and Wales, widening pre-existing health inequalities, said Evangelos Kontopantelis, who led the research. Between March and December of 2020, 1,645 years of life were lost per 100,000 of the population in the most deprived areas of England and Wales. In the most affluent areas of England and Wales, 916 years of life were lost per 100,000 people. The figures mean that almost twice as many years of life were lost in the very poorest areas of the country compared with the wealthiest. Broken down by geographic region, the highest rate was found in the northwest of England, where 1,550 years of life were lost per 100,000 of the population. The northeast of England, with 1,519 years of life lost, was the second worst hit area, followed by the West Midlands, with 1,475 years of life lost. The lowest rate was in the southwest of England, where 490 years of life were lost per 100,000 of the population. Next was the south central region of England, with 735 years of life lost, followed by the east of England, with 779 years of life lost. There was a difference of 729 excess years of life lost between the most deprived and the least deprived groups of people in England and Wales. Stark inequalities were also found when examining excess deaths, especially in younger age groups, the researchers said. There were 11 times as many excess deaths in deprived areas compared with the most affluent areas in 15 to 44-year-olds, three times as many in 45 to 64-year-olds, and almost twice as many in 65 to 74-year-olds. Excess deaths were 40% higher in 75 to 84-year-olds living in the most deprived areas of England and Wales compared with the least. Inequalities between socio-economic and geographic groups resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic are more pronounced than previously reported, the Manchester University researchers wrote. They added that future plans to manage pandemics should include an understanding of regional and socio-economic variation in years of life lost and how this has exacerbated long-standing health inequalities. Hannah Davis, of the Northern Health Science Alliance, who was not involved with the new research, said the study was further evidence of how devastating the impact of COVID-19 has been in communities in the north of England that were already suffering from deprivation before the coronavirus pandemic. Claire Bambra, a professor of public health at the University of Newcastle, added, "These findings reiterate that the pandemic has been very unequal. People in our most deprived communities have suffered most."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the state of heart. What will save us on the day of judgment? Are we favored based on our race or color? No. Then what is it? It is the place in our body which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made the location of the most valuable possession of a human being, which is iman, faith, and that place is your heart. What favors you in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the state of your heart. What will save you on the day of judgment is qalbun salim, a sound heart. The state of your heart will decide what you do with your knowledge. Will you benefit from it by practicing it or not? For example, if you hear a verse of Quran or a hadith, does it make you feel you want to practice it straight away, or does it not have much impact on you? Whatever the answer is, it will tell you about the state of your heart. For those whose state of the heart is clean and pure, as soon as they listen to an admonishment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of Prophet of Allah, or Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, or they, you know, recite a verse of Quran or read a hadith or a narration in a hadith book, the state of their heart is actually what triggers them to act on that. If the state of heart is filthy and it's darkened, then rest assured this person, number one, is not going to be interested in listening to this. And secondly, even if he gets to listen to this admonishment, he is not going to pay any attention. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the state of heart and how important it is. And we said that if somebody's state of heart is solid, it's pure, it's clean, it's transparent, then this person is going to be welcoming of the admonishments and of the commands of Allah, Prophet, and Ahlul Bayt. But if this person sins or sins too much and his heart has become darkened, this person is not going to be receptive towards the admonishments of Allah, Prophet, and Ahlul Bayt. Sins have an effect on your heart. Know this. They can cause your heart to be sealed so that the light of knowledge and guidance doesn't reach it anymore. And the verses of Quran don't affect this person anymore. May Allah Azza wa Jal protect us from this. Once our hearts get sealed, then there is no power that can provide us any guidance. There are many diseases we find in our hearts, like envy, hasad, greed, lust, and showing off.
Our aim should be to strive to purify our hearts and turn back to Allah with a sound heart. Again, remember, qalbun salim, a sound heart. Once a wise man made this dua, O Allah, purify my heart from anything but you. Because we know that the height of purity, the height of cleanliness, the height of that chastity is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's no one more purer than Him. So if Allah is the only one residing in our hearts, of course our hearts are going to be filled with guidance and knowledge. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
This is theft on a massive scale, and it is being done at a time when Afghanistan desperately needs an infusion of funds, says Daniel Larrison, writer, in an article published under the heading, Biden commits a grave injustice against the Afghan people. Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration is going to rob the people of Afghanistan of billions of dollars of their own money. Biden is starting to clear a legal path for relatives of victims of September 11, 2001 attacks to pursue $3.5 billion that Afghanistan's central bank had deposited in New York before the Taliban takeover, while also seeking to steer a roughly equal amount toward spending to aid the Afghan people. Beginning that process, Biden issued an executive order invoking emergency powers to consolidate and freeze all $7 billion of the total assets the Afghan Central Bank kept in New York. The administration said it would ask a judge for permission to move $3.5 billion to a trust fund it would set up to support the needs of the Afghan people, like for humanitarian relief. Instead of releasing funds to Afghanistan's central bank and allowing some level of normal economic activity to resume, the administration has managed to find an indefensible way to release the funds. The Humanitarian Trust Fund is an attempt to set up a mechanism outside of Afghanistan's institutions to funnel aid into the country, but the aid is going to be a trickle compared to what the Afghan people need to survive and recover. Emerson Brooking commented recently, "This is not just frozen assets. It is the entire reserve of the Afghan Central Bank. This act will destroy whatever remained of the formal Afghan economy. It will make Afghanistan entirely reliant on small rations of foreign aid. The decision to divide the money and keep half for families of 9/11 victims is outrageous, and it is difficult to see how the U.S. has any legal authority to use the funds in this way. The U.S. is simply taking the money because no one can stop it from doing so. The U.S. is supposed to be keeping that money in trust on behalf of Afghanistan's government. There is no good reason why money that belongs to the people of Afghanistan should be handed over to the victims of a crime committed by non-Afghans decades ago. This is theft on a massive scale, and it is being done at a time when Afghanistan desperately needs an infusion of funds. The Biden administration may think that it is staving off criticism from hawks by keeping the money for victims' families, but it is so cynical and morally bankrupt that it is rightly provoking a much bigger backlash than a simple unfreezing of assets over and ever would have. Murtaza Hussain adds, if Trump had done this, it would have been the most outrageous and vicious foreign policy thing he did during his entire presidency by far, almost incomprehensible. The United States regime is choosing to rob starving people in the middle of a humanitarian crisis created by the U.S. government's own policies. It is one more example of how U.S. punishes innocent people around the world for the crimes of others.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
We have made many achievements to this day, thanks to movement in the direction of the revolution. However, there is a long way till we reach those goals. Of course, we can attain them, provided that the train continues to move down the same railway, the same direction that Imam Rahmatullah Ali moved the train of the Islamic community. After Imam's demise, whenever we acted in a revolutionary manner, we managed to move forward. And whenever we ignore the revolutionary behavior and jihadi movement, we fell behind. We were frustrated. This was the reality. I myself was an official during those years. If there have been some flaws, this humble person is partly to blame. Whenever we preserved our revolutionary outlook, whenever we moved in a jihadi manner, and whenever we moved along the special track, we managed to move forward. On the other hand, whenever we showed negligence, we fell behind. We can catch up if we move forward in a revolutionary manner.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This message is being addressed with today's generation and to all future generations. This message is being addressed with all of us. Officials and the political, cultural and social activists are all the addressees of this statement. The youth, academic and seminarians and seminarian personalities, business people, villagers and city dwellers are all addressees of this statement. Everyone should know that this path can be taken with a revolutionary approach, and only then will progress be definite. Or we can move in a different direction, and then a dreadful fate will befall us. Imam Rahmatullah Alayh had a well-known statement he shared. He used to say, if this happens, it will be a slap in the face to Islam. If we change the path, the people of Iran will be slapped across the face, and so will Islam. There are many necessary things to say in this regard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalised several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over, and radicalise schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed, and we witnessed this firsthand, was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized. I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here, and we feel like every human being has a right to decide. They have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. The constitution also gives us right there like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an Iron Lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution, considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution, we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic handscarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main trump card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails.
They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This, as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's major performing arts event, Fajr International Theater Festival, wrapped up with an award ceremony on Tuesday. During the 40th edition of the annual event, theater ensembles from Iran and the world took to the stage to perform plays. And the best performances are now honored here.
It's important that we as young actors are evaluated by the jury. This gives us a stronger motivation to continue to make progress. I thank the organizers of the Fajr Theater Festival.
I was awarded for Best Playwright and Direction in the Radio Theater category. This is my second Fajr Award. My first experience at Fajr was at the age of 24.
Theater is the mother of cinema. Look at the great names in cinema industry. They have all started out as stage actors and actresses. So, Fajr Theater Festival plays an important role in boosting and promoting this important art.
Theater troops from Afghanistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Iraq, Italy, France, Algeria, and several other countries have been performing in the 40th edition of Fajr Festival. Out of a total of 100 plays, 20 are themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War, and three others are on the endeavors of health workers during the pandemic. Stage actors believe Fajr Festival provides a platform for the audience to get acquainted with the performing art of different nations.
The festival was a big stage for troops from many parts of the world. It's so interesting for us as actors to see our fellow actors from other nations perform. It also helps us learn about their culture and literature.
Every year in February, Iran organizes Fajr Theater Festival on the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Last year, the festival was held with no international participation due to COVID restrictions. And this year, the hosting halls have restricted their capacities to 30% amid the emergence of the Omicron variant. The 40th Fajr Theater Festival rolled down its curtain, with some winning a prize and others not. However, stage actors here say, aside from the competitive side of the event, it was a chance to learn about and enjoy the performances of other nations. And that's where the universality of the language of art comes into play. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The meeting between Vladimir Putin and Olaf Scholz was the first since Scholz's appointment as the German chancellor. During the talks, Putin called Germany one of Russia's main partners. The leaders touched upon the issue of Russia's proposals for security guarantees. The Russian president stressed that Moscow cannot turn a blind eye to how freely the United States and NATO interpret the principles of the indivisibility of security, noting that the expansion of the North Atlantic alliance to the east continues, despite the assurances of Western partners.
About the expansion of NATO, here you said a wonderful phrase. They say that Ukraine will not be in NATO in the coming years. What does they say mean? You and I must understand what is spoken in interstate relations. We have been told for 30 years that there will be no NATO expansion at all, not one inch towards the Russian borders. And today we see the NATO infrastructure right at our house.
Putin added the postponement